So, Russ, this is, what, episode 8?
This is episode 8.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, just already, my entire, I don't want to say understanding, my entire appreciation of all this jazz I didn't know about has already changed my listening habits after only 8 episodes. And I have to thank you for that. That's it's pretty amazing. I'm hearing a lot of great jazz, including this week.
That's right. Yeah, it's amazing with streaming now, regardless of what you think about streaming or if it alters your buying habits, the access and just knowing about so much music that's out there, that if you actually go to buy it, it's kind of hard. You have to work to find it. So you would never have come across it any other way. Mm. So at least we live in an age where if you have an open mind to it, the music will find you somehow.
Right. I'm finding that's true of a lot of the classical music I'm listening to as well. There's kind of things that we're trying out.
There's all kinds of things.
That I wouldn't have bought otherwise. It's pretty interesting. All right.
So it's a rainy night on Easter here in Western Japan. And happy Easter
to
you, Mike.
Yeah, happy Easter. And to happy Easter to you, Russ. And, this and is, to all listeners.
Yes,
who
this
are,
is episode 8.
I hope you listened to your Bach Passions this week. I did.
Passionately. Episode 8 of Adult Music, the podcast with music for the mature mind. We've got a nice program that's going to take us around the globe this evening. And we'd like to ask our listeners, and we've noticed we've got some listeners around the world. This week, we've got a listener in Romania who's downloaded all of our episodes, it seems. So shout out to you in Romania.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. And other countries around the world, we've got listeners in India, Portugal, Argentina, Mexico, Spain, France, lots of places.
The audience is growing fairly quickly. Yeah. That's a good thing and really makes us happy.
We've popped in and out of the Apple recommended category for music commentary, but it's based on an algorithm, and we'd like to stay in there. So if you're listening to us and you're enjoying the content, please make a comment, subscribe. That will help keep us up in the browse category so people can find us more easily, whatever service you're on. And we've also got our own email if you'd like to send any comments or questions to us, which is adultmusicpodcast@gmail.com. So we'd like to find out who's listening to us, where you're at, and what's going on. So
yes,
please subscribe, rate, and contact us.
So hold on, that's Adult Music Podcast. Just one whole word with
just
no spaces
one word,
or lines
no
or
spaces.
Anything? Okay, at gmail.com. At gmail.com. Please write to us. We'd like to hear from you.
That's right.
What else? Oh, one more thing. Please, on your whatever, if you're like us and you're listening on a whatever service you're listening on, please rate us. Give us a 5-star rating. We could use it. We're a new podcast. It really does help those things. And for you, it just takes a second. You don't have to write your name or anything. Just, if you just give us a 5-star rating, it'll help us out.
It's free. Yeah, help us get noticed. That's what we need at this point, is just to... We're not aiming for a large audience because we're in that 1% category. If you look at the type of classical music or jazz listeners, it's usually between like 1 and 3% of market share. But we know those people are out there around this globe. They're people who are interested in adult music, and we just need to find our audience.
Well, that's sort of why we started the podcast. We're really looking for people like us, or at least who are interested in kind of getting to know this music a little bit. One of the things I've found as a music educator is people are not really Japanese people, but Western people are often rather intimidated by classical music. And I suspect the same is true of jazz. I think they kind of, especially Americans, they kind of get this idea that it's like an elite kind of music. And it requires a bit more understanding than like your ordinary pop song. But it really is there for everybody, and we should all be listening to it. And it's really, it's fantastic. It'll like just make your life that much better, I think.
Well, yeah, you know,
it certainly makes my life better.
The difference between pop culture and art is, you know, we're bombarded with commercialized material that we're supposed to consume that comes to us, and we have to sort of plug our ears or cover our eyes to get away from it. But art, you have to go to. And
right.
It can be a
big
leap.
You have to meet it halfway.
can be a leap of faith at the beginning, but it needn't be intimidating. And whenever we approach a new style of music or any other sort of cuisine or something, you know, we have to take a step at first. And so if we can help ease that step in some things that we've experienced, and I hope to take some new steps on my own, which I'll talk more about later in one of my choices today. So,
right.
Yeah, we just want to find that kind of people who are open to new listening experiences and maybe can share some ideas with us.
Yeah, I also want to mention the arts, you know, if we, you know, the both of us know quite a bit about music because we've just been listening to it for our entire lives. But the arts is something you never stop learning. Like, you can't really ever call yourself like an expert. Like, I know the arts. They're always changing and opinions about it are always kind of moving. So, you know, it's don't worry about it. Just listen, keep building up your understanding and, you know, deepen your feeling for music. It'll be a great thing. Okay.
Yeah, we're not going to become some kind of artsy, pretentious podcast. That would suck.
Yeah, if we knew everything, we'd kind of, then the life wouldn't be worth living anymore, right?
We'd just listen to it by ourselves. Yeah.
We'd just listen to it by ourselves. Yeah. Part of the reason we started this podcast is because I think people started getting annoyed at us meeting together at parties and just talking only about music and just pretty much leaving everybody else out of the conversation.
We could alienate a group really easily.
Yeah.
So we're going to find our other aliens around the globe. And
okay.
And speaking on the globe, our journey tonight starts in Austria.
In Austria. It's pretty much a European one. Yeah.
This is a European and South American adventure.
It is a South American. Yeah, I forgot about that. Okay. Yeah.
We'll start in Europe, then we'll go down into South America and come back to Europe at the end. But we're going to start in Austria with a forgotten composer.
Yeah, and someone who, it turns out, who knew? Who should be remembered or should be was a big this was a big discovery. Okay, the composer we're talking about is an Austrian composer by the name of Hans Roth. Okay? That's Rott. And two albums were recently released by the Capriccio label of his orchestral works. One of them was released just last January and the other one the previous one was in September, so they're kind of back to back pretty quickly. So we've heard, it seems like, all of his orchestra works on these two CDs, and all that's left is a handful of chamber works. So we might get that one day too. We'll have to see. There's nothing at the moment.
So,
and this was a revelation.
It was. I think I stumbled upon these, and I had never heard of Roth, and I think I said
neither had I. Yeah.
Check this out. So he lived a very short life of only 25 years between 1858 and 1884. And he studied organ with Bruckner, who was an organ teacher. And apparently, well, we never learned this about classical composers so much, but Bruckner was also known to be a great improviser. And apparently, Roth
the
was
the
also,
best of his generation, in fact, they say.
And that was also supposed to be something that Roth was very good at, too. So he was a good organ pupil. And when he was at conservatory, he actually was a roommate of Mahler, if you can imagine that.
Right.
Wonder what kind of roommate he was. But in his short 25 years, he did write a lot of interesting music here. And you can definitely see, when I listen to these, and I love Bruckner, especially for his brass writing, because as a brass player, you know, I'm in lots of symphonies, I'm always wanting more brass. And, you know, Bruckner was one of those composers who give you some satisfying brass. And I have to say that Roth, his brass arrangements are really wonderful. And all of his compositions on these two volumes have really great melodies. This one starts out.
This was
Yeah, they're great.
These pulled me in right away. It was really amazing.
Yeah, there's one of the pieces on here. I think it's on the first disc. The Pastoral Prelude. It just has some amazing low brass parts in it, and yeah, they're just really satisfying. And then I found the first, the Symphony 1. that's included here.
That's the, I think that's the key work. This is on volume two. Yeah. Okay. The symphony number
it's
one.
Very, overall, it's just majestic. And the third movement has brass fanfares. And then the fourth movement starts out with these very low bass notes and then goes through this kind of brass chorale type of writing that's very evocative of Bruckner's kind of music. And then maybe.
And Wagner, really.
Wagner also.
I think of Wagner, too. Yeah.
And then I also enjoyed, with no brass, the Symphony for String Orchestra. The second movement, when I was listening to it, was very interesting. It was composed of these sort of series of minor phrases, but that all end in major cadences. Mm. So they sort of have a turnaround that you're expecting to be going back to something major, and then they go into minor. So he's using some very ear-catching sort of melodic type and harmonic type of things in there. And it's amazing that he had such a short life, and but his music is so accessible. So you know, anyone who likes romantic era symphonies with lots of good melodies and emotional contrasts in there, I think would be drawn to his music. It's just that apparently in his lifetime and shortly thereafter, there was so much going on in the music world that it just got sort of put on the shelf, swept away, and not
well,
until
he was
recent
also,
times.
Yeah, he was very young when he died. He apparently, he didn't get any of his works performed outside of his schooling. Okay, there were his works were performed by the students, like people like Mahler would have heard them, you know, when they were at school. And he apparently had some kind of a mental breakdown after. I think was it Hans Richter? I don't remember who it was, but somebody refused to perform his first symphony, which is a really great work, by the way,
yeah,
as we now know. And he had a mental breakdown like 3 days later and was institutionalized and just died the sad death in a mental institution at the age of 25. Now, part of the reason you hear this music and it's immediately appealing, it's fairly harmonically complex, but a 25-year-old isn't composing the way, say, a 40 or 50 year old is. Like, once you get all of these, this extra experience, you've written all these works, you find new little tricks or sort of ways to express your ideas, you get new ideas. I mean, we don't know what he would have become. He might have been one of the great composers of the 19th and maybe early 20th century. Incidentally, he was Mahler's age, I guess. 1858 now, maybe a little.
Well, if they were
young,
roommates,
older
they had
than
to be
Mahler.
Pretty close. Yeah.
They had to be pretty close. But Mahler, one of the things I noticed about this in the first symphony, instantly, by the way, this is labeled the first symphony. He wrote only one complete symphony. The second symphony is incomplete. Right? And I think there's a movement of it. And I'm not sure if that's the last movement on this album.
There's an extra movement
I'm not sure.
Sort of tacked on there, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what that is, but that might be the, maybe not. Maybe, I can't really say. It was just a movement that just didn't find its way into a symphony. And then there's a symphony for string orchestra, too, which doesn't really count as a numbered symphony. It's just kind of a different type of animal. In these, by the way, first of all, these recordings, these are by the Gersenich Orchestra Köln, with Christopher Ward conducting. These are beautiful recordings,
yeah,
first of all,
nice,
too.
Nice recordings. They're on Capriccio. Capriccio.
Yeah, Capriccio.
Label.
You know, detail is very clear, and this is the era of the gigantic orchestra. I think Mahler and Wagner as well, his orchestral writing. Bruckner as well. And really, this the whole late 19th, early 20th century, when like the colors of the orchestra were really important. You hear a lot of that here.
Yeah, he slots right in. I mean, in that category, in that time period. And with all of these ideas at such a young age, if he had even lived to be 50, it's hard. You know, he could have done lots of amazing things. So this is a great find, but also sort of a sad note of history that he didn't live to do more.
Yeah. The works are really immediately catchy. I mean, you don't really, you know, a lot of Bruckner's music or even Wagner's can be very, you have to kind of work for it a little bit. You know, they're
dense.
Not like melodically catchy.
Yeah.
They're dense. Yeah. Not here. I mean, these are fairly dense works, but they're just, there's a lot of sugar coating on them. That makes them immediately appealing. Content. Strong melodic ideas. Mm-hmm. Very catchy. Very broad gestures, as we expect from anyone who's inspired by Wagner. Wagner was really the key composer of the era. There are a lot of, you know, it's funny that he was Mahler's roommate, because I think Mahler was kind of, Rothe died in 1884, which is around the time Mahler was doing the first version of his first symphony. Okay, it was the five movement version. It eventually became a four movement symphony. And there are a lot of ideas from this symphony that made its way into Mahler's music, as I suspect he. Now, you know, is he lifting these ideas from Rhodes? Is he just kind of ripping them off? Or is he like concerned that he liked the idea so much he didn't want them to just disappear? You know, you can be charitable and say, you know, he wanted to preserve these ideas in his own works.
Sounds like a movie.
If you know Mahler's Third Symphony, in the opening of the First Symphony, Rhodes' First Symphony, reminds me of the post-horn solo from the third movement of Mahler's Third Symphony. Do you know that part? With the
Yeah.
It's this movement that has these kind of mechanical rhythms that's supposed to represent like animals. You know, they don't really think. They just sort of like, they're in the present, they do what they want. And then there's a man passes by the scene and he's playing this beautiful melody on the post horn. The animals are sort of mesmerized by him. This is what's supposed to be happening musically in the scene. And the post horn solo really just, I think it was lifted, kind of, or not lifted, but it was sort of
inspired.
It was reshaped. Yeah, inspired, yes. Let's say. It was reshaped. It's different, but it's the character is the same as the Rhodes Symphony. And there's another one too. Let's see. Yeah, this is like, I wrote here that this symphony, it's full of slowly building cadences and glowing orchestration, evoking the candlelit world of the 19th century.
Ooh, wow.
That's nice.
That's some flowery praise.
That is some flowery praise. Oh, that's the way I felt about it.
Good. I really enjoyed these too. I listened to it when it first came out. I think, you know, I stumbled across this and recommended it to you. And then, you know, I listened to it at that time, and then when we said, oh, let's do that. And I came back and listened to it again. And it was another revelation. It's like, wow, these are so great. Anyone who likes big romantic era orchestral works and hasn't heard this will be very pleased, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. More Mahler, by the way. In the third movement, you can hear the opening of the second movement of Mahler's First Symphony. Okay. Dun, 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 dun. He's got that rhythm going too.
Right.
I think Mahler was listening very carefully to this guy's music.
Could be.
Okay. Rhodes did it first, but Mahler kind of said, you know, he was a more mature composer at the time. Rhodes died very, he was very young. So, Mahler gets the credit, I guess, for making it like last. All right.
Yeah.
All right, so we want to recommend these. Please,
strong
everybody,
recommendation
listen.
On this,
strong
yes.
recommendation on both volumes. There are two volumes to this. Okay, so we're not just going to stop with the first volume. Okay, anything else you want to say about this?
No, just listen to
no,
it.
No, we're good. Listen,
you'll like it.
They're great. Okay,
you'll like it.
Yeah, either one. Just start with either one. We recommend volume two, the Symphony Number 1, the most. But might want to start with volume one. It's got shorter works. The Hamlet Overture.
Yeah,
there's a suite in E major. Yeah. Okay.
No
the pastoral
here at
prelude,
all.
Which doesn't really sound pastoral at all. It's kind of dark.
Yeah. With that low brass, like I said.
I think the opening, the pastoral title comes from
maybe
the opening.
Had some big cows in the pasture.
Maybe they were
not,
brooding
not the
cows.
Pastoral,
they were,
but the pastoral. Yeah, I don't know what that. It didn't match my image, but I liked it when I got to the end. You know, so.
Yeah. All right, onwards. Now, for our next journey to Argentina, we said South America, 2021. Is a year of many anniversaries. Now, musical anniversaries are really big in classical music. They're like an excuse to rediscover certain composers' music. Like last year in 2020 was the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth. And it was supposed to be a big Beethoven year, but the coronavirus struck and everything went online. So I was posting about Beethoven a lot. This year, it turns out there are a lot of anniversaries, and we'll be getting into some of them. Okay, so the first one we're going to talk about, and it's the only one today, is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Astor Piazzolla. This is his South American composer of tango-influenced music. He kind of took the tango form and made it into like this high art. It was really like a music of the people. And a lot of his contemporaries were not happy that he did that. But now that he's like, you know, he's dead and gone, he's sort of acknowledged as one of the greats of just really world-class music, and certainly of Argentinian composers too.
Yeah, he brings in, you know, classical elements and jazz elements, and it's very interesting. The tango is always present, but it's sort of enveloped in lots of other sorts of, you know, non-native to tango things. But I think in the scope, you know, he created something new out of tango that is always very interesting to me.
Yeah, incidentally, his birthday was March 11th, so his 100th birthday is past. But nevertheless, we will be hearing, I'm sure, Piazzolla music all year. Okay, so we've got two recommendations again. So we doubled up again. There are two recordings of Piazzolla's music, along with I'll get to this in a minute. The first one we're going to talk about is on the Alpha label. This is Ksenia Sidorova, and she's playing the accordion, and the album is called Piazzolla Reflections. Okay, and there's a rather attractive cover of her looking all pouty on the cover. She's Latvian.
She is, how can I say?
With a giant accordion covering her body.
She's very visually appealing.
Yes. Yeah, she's pretty sexy.
Yeah.
So is the other one, actually. And disc two on Warner Classics. Let me just mention this. Is Lucien Renaudin-Valry, who I guess is French. I didn't look this up. But Piazzolla's stories.
Extremely French.
Okay,
I was going to say that Sidorova is an accordion player, but actually Piazzolla played, it's not the accordion, what do they call it?
The bandoneon.
Bandoneon, which is sort of a type of an accordion, but it's actually different and has different...
It has buttons only. About it, right? Yeah. The accordion has like a keyboard on it, and buttons on one side and keyboard on the other. So Sidorova is playing the accordion. So on this album, now the key work on this, the central work, is probably the biggest work Piazzolla ever wrote, the Bandoneon Concerto, and this is really a full blown concerto for that instrument. That has tango elements, but it's got a lot of like sort of classical underpinnings as well. Sidorova plays this on the accordion.
Yeah.
And it's apparently quite a challenge to do. It's really written for the bandoneon. It sits more comfortably on that instrument. So she gets a lot of expression out of it as well. All right. This whole program, by the way, Piazzolla manages to vary, like Russ said, the tango elements in his works. But rather cleverly, both of these programs, the Sidorova one and the Renaudin-Valry one, both vary also the types of music and the composers and the orchestration to make these really excellent programs to listen to. They're easy to sit through. So it's like just one tango work after another.
Of the two, I think it's more successful on the accordion one, which I'll explain in a bit. Yeah. So in addition to, the instrumentation is varied. So we have different backing ensembles. And also on the accordion album here, the Reflections, we've got pieces by Roffi, which is a nocturne, which I thought was quite beautiful. And we also have a piece by Sergei Akhunov, which a Russian accordion composer. And I found that piece quite interesting, too.
Interesting is a good word. It's kind of hard to grasp, really. It's abstract.
Yeah, it's abstract.
I thought.
Well, after we discuss the other one, I'll compare it. But I found even we have these additional composers mixed in, to me, the sort of thematic cohesion worked much better on the accordion album than it does on the trumpet album. And I'll say why that is once we discuss that other one. But I found, when I first thought this, I thought, well, can I listen to a whole album of accordion music, you know?
Because well, it turns out you don't really have to, because there's a lot of solos for other instruments as well.
Yeah. So I was really pleased beyond my expectations. And she's really a, you know, nuanced player and brings out the contrasts and interesting sort of
elements,
the emotions, in Piazzolla's compositions. And so I really enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would.
The emotions that this instrument is capable of bringing out are rather surprising. There's a kind of wistfulness to it, you know. It's kind of it can be also very violent and angry sounding too.
Sure.
It's pretty amazing, and yet there's a lot of joyful moments as well in this music. You know, the accordion can really bring that out as well. This sort of music. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's to me usually when I'm listening with accordion, it's sort of a backing instrument. So I haven't listened to a lot of recordings where the accordion is front and center in the main instrument, so that's one sort of adjustment for me. But also the jazz guitarist Al Di Meola has done a few albums of Piazzolla recordings, and he records with Bandolier, musician, and so I started to listen to that as an additional melodic instrument there, and it got me kind of turned on. And you know, like I said, this one was sort of opening my eyes to the possibilities of the nuances you can get with just not just squeezing the box in the background or adding another sort of layer of texture of sound. And I think it's the overall journey of music on here is pretty satisfying and successful.
Right. Piazzolla's music, especially with the bandoneon or the accordion in this case, kind of, I always think of music, associate music with a time of day. I guess I got that from Indian music, because they always have like a time of day that this particular rag is supposed to be played. But Piazzolla's music, late night. Maybe after having a lot to drink in a bar and you're kind of sorry you did it. it's that kind of emotion.
The rhythm's going
You're just kind of contemplating, you know, the shortness of life and how you're just thrown it away, sort of. It has that kind of feeling to it. It's not sad music, though. It's oddly uplifting and really compelling. Late nights when you're feeling wistful and blue is kind of the thing I wrote down here.
Oh.
Okay. And I think the accordion really evokes that feeling a lot better than the trumpet. I'm wondering if that's what you're going to say when we get to the trumpet. I liked the other recording as well, but it has a very different feel to it. I want to mention both of these recordings have like a solo work, by Johann Sebastian Bach. The trumpet one has one of the movements of the violin, one of the violin sonatas, from the Sonatas and Partitas, while this one, Sidorova on the accordion, she plays the Adagio in D minor from BWV 974. Okay, Johann Sebastian Bach's concerto after Alessandro Marcello's concerto for oboe and strings. All right, this one has a lot of the extra works on this by the modern composers, Russ mentioned Pietro Roffi. That was a beautiful work. I like the Frank Angelus a lot too. Fantasy and Anathema, Piazzolla, Chiquilin de Bachin. It was really nice. The Sidorova record, highly recommended, has this late night wistful blue sort of feeling to it, a little heavy and just kind of soothing. Okay. For the cares of the worries of the world. Okay. All right. Going on to the other one, the Lucienne Renaudin Value one. This is a kind of a similar program. She also has, taken some of Piazzolla's works and mixed them in with, works from other, composers, but she's really gone for something quite more, Argentinian. She's got a work by Alberto Ginastera on here, another Argentinian composer from the 20th century. One of his Danzas Argentinas is Richard Galliano, who does a tango. There's also a Bach work, and there's also a work by Nadia Boulanger. This very beautiful Lux Aeterna from the Requiem Mass. Boulanger was Piazzolla was one of her many students, all of whom seemed to have become great composers in the 20th century. So Piazzolla was one of her later students that studied with her, along with people like Bernstein, Philip Glass, Aaron Copland. There were so many. So she gets a nod on this too, and she also plays Paganini's violin caprice, which was kind of interesting to hear on a trumpet. Go ahead.
As far as the variations on programming the content other than Piazzolla, I thought it's much less successful on this recording. I would have much preferred to leave the Bach and Paganini off from here, especially the Paganini. This is more like...
I actually thought that was an odd choice, yeah.
It's a technical exercise on trumpet because it's extremely difficult to do something like this. But it's out of character, I felt, with the Piazzolla. And the Bach, just from a period standpoint and style of music, I was distracted from my sort of tango zone with this. So I would have removed these as a sort of producer or something. So I guess I'll talk about this because I was interested as a trumpet player. Renaudin is a very virtuosic player. She has great technique on trumpet, that's for sure. And she has a very fabulous sound.
Yeah.
Sound quality. And it's interesting here compared with the accordion because the Piazzolla pieces she's chosen have wonderful melodies to them. And they sound great on the trumpet because the melody stands out more than it does on accordion. Because on the accordion, you're going to have various notes with the same tonal character with the harmony and the melody. But on the trumpet, of course, you're limited to one note. So that melody really stands out. And you can see the beauty of Piazzolla's melody lines. And so I thought, this sounds really good on trumpet. And she's a fabulous player and technically amazing. The one thing I felt about this is just my observation. And, someone else might think this is not really on the mark. But when it comes to trumpet players, there's sort of national characters, and we've talked about this before, but I don't know if nationalities influence sounds. I believe that like Latino players play with a different articulation, and the tones I hear in trumpet, there's a very German style sound that I hear in some great German trumpet players, but her sound to me is so French. It's extremely French, and that French sort of sound on this sort of South American music, it's satisfying, but I thought it sort of changed the character of the music a bit to me. So it got me thinking about have any Argentinian trumpet players recorded these, just a quick look. And then I thought when we go back, when we were in episode 3, when we were looking at the Grammy Awards, one of the Latin jazz suggestions that I had as was a great album was the Diego Urcola duet El Duelo with Paquito de Rivera.
I heard that one.
On that album, we have a Piazzolla song, Libertango.
Mm.
And also on another one of his albums, that would be Viva. He has a Piazzolla recording, Adios Nonino. And although he's more of a jazz player, I'm sure he has a classical background as well with his amazing technique that he has. I would like to hear someone like him or South American Argentinian player do their sort of version of Piazzolla songs for trumpet. because I just felt like her, the overwhelming sort of French approach to trumpet. I would actually maybe like to hear her play a lot of the pieces that we reviewed last week in the modern French.
Well, yeah, they were all French songs.
And maybe she's recorded a lot of those pieces. I'm sure I have to look into her catalog a little bit more. Right. But that's how I felt. The playing on this is great. Exquisite trumpet playing. Stylistically, it just, especially when I got to the Bach and Paganini, I felt like I was on a different album. And then, you know, coming back to that.
It is a change of pace, but Piazzolla actually played Bach on the Bandoneon often, and he recommended that it be done. So I think she wanted to just make a nod towards that. I think that's why she did it.
Sure.
Also, the other point I want to make is she actually has a far more, like, let's say, Argentinian program. Like, she ends with Volver by Carlos Gardel, who really is the king of tango music, when he's sort of the godfather of it, let's say. He's, you know, the traditional tango. Piazzolla wouldn't be considered traditional. He really changed it a lot. So there's that. The other thing I would mention, the trumpet, this is just the character of the sound of the trumpet, is it just makes this for a very different album to begin with. The trumpet has a brighter sound. This is a brighter sound than the accordion, you know? And it's sort of, when we think of like Piazzolla's music and the tango, there's a kind of sadness to it, like a wistfulness to it, even like sometimes
it's a
violence
of
to it.
That I find,
but yeah,
in,
you don't really,
tango,
it is, it's a change of emotions. It's very different. Okay. That's not a bad thing, though. I mean, I certainly think this record should be heard. I liked it a lot. I can't really complain. But I was kind of more drawn to the Sidorova, myself. Okay. And that's... so anyway, but what I want to say is here in the 100th anniversary year of Piazzolla's birth, these are two excellent records to listen to. And if you want to become familiar with Piazzolla's music and some others who admired him and some of his contemporaries and his life.
Both very nice, yeah.
Both very nice. I think I'd go for the accordion one more, though, because it's just more sort of authentic to him.
Right.
Okay. And that's going to be it for Classical this week, because we just went to town on jazz recordings.
And we're going back to Europe.
Yeah. We're going, European jazz. Okay, this is not going to be an American trip this year.
European jazz.
This week.
And I hear a sound.
And?
It's a sound of a siren.
Is that at your house?
No, it's the next album we're going to talk about.
Oh, I'm trying to think of what that might be. Let me see. Oh, I think I know.
Yeah, it's a small country, relatively speaking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. We're talking about the album, The Siren.
That's right.
Yeah, okay, by Susana Alexandra, who is a Latvian jazz singer. Okay, now I actually picked this one, and I had read about it in a review. Okay, and the reviewer was kind of enamored of the record. He mentioned that it was a really sort of fresh voice, and it just kind of made his day to hear this. It was just something a little different. So I figured I had to hear it, and indeed, I liked it as well. I don't think I liked it as much as he did, but this is an album of original material, mostly. I think there are two covers on it. Okay, Blame It on My Youth is a cover, and then she does a Finnish folk tune as well. But all the rest of these songs that she sings here are original. She's co-writer on most of them, but not all of them. Okay, how can I explain this? These are let's see. These are songs that Alexandra is from Latvia, and she's been singing, I guess, jazz for her entire life or whatever. And she has this, I think that the thing that appealed to me about this was just the sweetness of her voice. It's rather unusual for a jazz voice. It's kind of sweet and sort of unassuming. There's no real darkness to it. It's bright and sunny. I don't know. That's not really, doesn't really catch it, but there's a kind of like joy to the singing that I really enjoyed. Also, the arrangements, the solos on this were rather a little different than what you're used to in jazz. I thought this was pretty, you know, just appealing really all the way through. I liked it a lot. I don't know if I loved it, but it was a change of pace. I really don't know how to describe this. It's kind of, it hasn't really gone into my head yet. I'm kind of looking for words for this one. I don't know. What did you think?
Well, I have a strange opinion about this one.
Yeah.
Because I actually liked the material.
Yeah, me too.
And the choice of songs a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But her voice didn't,
no, you didn't
catch me. Now, okay. You know, when I listen to vocals, I sort of have a different visceral criteria than I do for a lot of other music. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for some sort of human or emotional element that really is unique or grabs me. And I just didn't find it in her voice.
I thought the sound of her voice was unique for jazz, actually.
It's okay, unique. Kinda... She doesn't sound like a jazz singer. And
yeah.
On the one hand, for, most of the jazz singers I'm listening to are American singers.
Right,
so there's
right.
There's a few European singers. There's an Italian jazz singer I listen to, Roberta something or other, and a few other ones. But most of them are, you know, American singers. So I don't know mm-hmm. a lot of European jazz singers. And, you know, so certainly there can't be that many Latvian jazz singers. Hmm. So I'm interested if there are some. But, you know, for me, the most important thing of a vocalist is always that unique characteristic of the voice, whether it catches me or not. And for her, it just doesn't on this album anyway. I might feel different on different material because I actually liked the material. It struck me as material that wasn't jazzy in nature, but yet she has, you know, found some improvisation. There's some scat vocals and things on here, but
it had sort of a free feel. And I thought the scat vocals were quite good too. I think this album made me feel sort of free. It was kind of it was sort of fresh sounding, I think.
Yeah. I like the material and I like the arrangements and what was done. Maybe it's just that her voice for me doesn't really give me that much of a connection yet.
Right.
So
good soloing by the pianist, Jonas Haavisto. Okay. These are all Finnish names.
Right.
Okay. Anyway, so I want to just, if you want to try something different, Susanna Alexandra, The Siren, that's her new album. It came out about actually a few weeks ago, I think. Oh no, maybe February. I'm not sure. Okay.
This is one thing too, and I don't want to unfairly judge her on this recording, but I've also found, you know, in the jazz tradition, when you come up as a musician or a singer, it's usual that you're going to come up with the jazz standards, the American songbook, and sort of emulate your influences first. And, you know, those are the sort of the benchmarks, so to speak. And then your influences will be known. Are you influenced by Ella Fitzgerald? Are you influenced by Sarah Vaughan? Is Billie Holiday your main influence? These things will be known. And it's not a shame to sound or emulate like your hero. And so you copy the best from them and then hopefully you add something unique to them. This is the same with an instrument in jazz. You copy the masters and then find your own voice and go out there. So I don't know. I'm assuming she has other recordings where she's probably
done
those standards, but I've not heard those. So when I start with an artist on any instrument, I want to hear them coming up and see where they came from before I hear their new material. Now, there have been some new singers in jazz world that sort of jump to albums of their own original material quite early. I'm not sure that she's like that. That's to me is sort of a dangerous mark. You know, you want to have at least a few albums of mixtures of things. The reason is it gives you sort of a launching ground, I think, to absorb and show where you fit in the tradition and then introduce your own material. So I haven't heard this vocalist Alexandra's other recordings, so I didn't quite know, you know, where I'm going to relate what she's doing to sort of the vocal tradition. So it could be a problem with maybe with enjoying the material, but not really knowing what she's aiming for overall stylistically. But I'm open to listening to some more things. I wouldn't judge any artist on just one recording. So,
yeah, she does have earlier albums. I'm sure she does like covers on them, but I haven't heard those myself. Right. I just went right to this one. I just want to say one more thing about that. I don't know if I mentioned this already. I really enjoyed the playing on the album too. These sort of extended, sort of, I guess you could call them solos, but they were kind of more. They're more like these washes of sound, sort of, you know.
They're passages. It's not indulgent nice, at all. It's nice. The arrangements are tight and serve the overall song.
And then they're not very traditional either. I don't know. I liked it. It was catchy and it was free and something new. There you go.
Yeah. Hey, I applaud and appreciate, especially all of these European jazz releases. And
We've got three more coming.
We do.
All right, let's get to them.
All right.
What do we got?
The next one is the one... Actually, so I'm going to take you through a simulated time period journey as we go through Europe here and go to Denmark, Italy, and then Slovenia and back to Denmark again. And also through jazz time periods here. And the first two will be quite comfortable. And the last one will be a challenge. And we'll talk about that challenge when we get to it as well. But the first one is the one I'm most enthusiastic about as a very interesting find in jazz. And this is the drummer Snorre Kirk, who is Norwegian born. As I looked up his history, I believe he came to Denmark at a young age and was educated there, and that's his home now. So he plays on the Danish music scene, and this is a album called Going Up on Stunt Records by the Snorre Kirk Quartet. And they're also joined with the American tenor saxophonist Stephen Riley. And the rest of the group is rounded out Magnus Jorth on piano, bassist Anders Feldstedt, and their own tenor saxophonist, Jan Harbeck. And so Snorre is a drummer. He's, I believe he's 39 years old, and he's very active in the Danish music scene. And what makes his playing unique is as a drummer, he's also a composer. And I believe one of his early albums is called Composer and Drummer. And so his music style is very much in the swing style. So if you're a fan of music of, say, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, his writing is very much inside of that era of pre-bebop, 1930s, early 40s jazz music. And all of his albums have original compositions, but they sound like something you've heard before because they really reflect those American songbook of jazz standards, but they're new. And the other interesting thing about him is that his drumming is it's very subtle, which is what I like, because whenever we hear usually like famous drummers, we get into these like bombastic extended solos, you know. And to me, the best drummer is the one that's not noticed unless you really pay attention. And he's that kind of drummer. He has a very subtle, stylish drumming. Even on this album, there isn't a real drum solo. It's sort of an extended break at the end of a song, and that's the most he indulges. I was reading about him and translating some of the press that's about him. There was an unattributed quote that said, "Who on earth is that drummer writing so well, yet playing so little himself?" Which I thought was exactly how I felt after listening to his albums.
and the sign of a master musician.
Yeah. And so what you'll hear on this album is a bunch of his originals with his quartet, joined by the saxophonist Stephen Riley. Now, Stephen Riley is also quite accomplished American musician. He's played with a number of groups. Probably most well-known would be Wynton Marsalis and also the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. And his characteristic is this huge, airy tone. So you'll hear his sax sound, but with the sax tone, there's equal amounts of breath. So it's almost as if you're hearing him breathe through the saxophone. It's a really unique and very fat, hearty tenor sound. And he's very good at playing in this period style before bebop. So most of the modern tenor players will be emulating some aspect of John Coltrane's style, because that sort of defined modern saxophone. But here we hear with these two players, Riley and Harbeck, this sort of distillation of the sounds of pre-bebop on tenor saxophone, the sounds of Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, Lester Young, whether light and airy or fat and sexy. These two guys can do that all. And so that's really the element of this music that really makes you tap your toe and listen to this. Very nice, because normally Scandinavian jazz can have an image of being kind of dark, sort of like the Icelandic and other music we mentioned.
Well, certainly the classical music from those lands are like that. There's a kind of darkness and a sort of sparseness to it, like the icy landscape or something.
Actually,
like
there's
that.
A sparseness in this music, but it's a good sparseness. And this recording quality here is pristine. It sounds really good. And although I can really recommend this album going up strongly, I listened to his whole back catalog, which goes back to about 2012. And
wow.
I would recommend other albums before this one. So my favorite one of his, he has another album with Riley from 2 years previously called Tangerine Rhapsody, which is it's very much in the same vein. Excellent breathy sax, beautiful lines by Riley. But I think for me, the peak is an album he made in 2018 called Beat. And the reason why I like this one better, it's just that it has a larger instrumentation. Other Danish musicians on trumpet, sax, and clarinet, which you have that mixture in jazz. The ensemble playing and the interplay is just great. I recommend starting with this album and listen to the title track, Beat. It has the dirtiest sax solo I've ever heard. And it's so dirty that I have to keep going back and listening to it. And you almost need a shower after you listen to it. It's that dirty. You'll feel like you spilled buttered popcorn on your lap or something. But it's that good. Oh, you have to hear this.
Or somewhere else.
Yeah, somewhere else. This is great. And also, earlier, I think his debut album from 2012 is an album called Blues Modernism. And this is a collection of blues and bluesy tunes, all originals again. They're very minimalist, but exquisitely done. And I think this one won the Jazz Album of the Year in Denmark. So this is music that should be heard for a number of reasons. An interesting drummer who never overplays. He only serves the songs which he composes. And they're exquisitely done in a style we don't get to hear that's swing. And yet it's not nostalgic, but somehow fresh, even in this modern day. And anyone would like this. You put this on and everyone from your 4-year-old to grandma will be tapping their toes. and listen to this. What did you think about this one, Mike? You like it?
Yeah, this put a big smile on my face right from the beginning. That's that whole swing rhythm. You had mentioned that he's kind of a subtle drummer, and certainly you can get into that. But the swing rhythm is just tight in there the whole way through. And you don't really even need to be listening closely to enjoy this. It's just there's a lot on the surface as well. Yeah. To enjoy. I didn't do the deep dive into his other recordings that you did, but I think I want to now, especially after hearing you talk about them.
That one is just the one with combination.
That's the one with the dirty sax solo.
Dirty sax solo. Oh, it's so dirty. Yeah.
The dirty breathy sax solo. You had mentioned also that breathiness of playing. I think of Stan Getz when I think of breathy sax.
A Lester Young aficionado, yeah.
Right, Lester Young, people like that. That's disappeared now, hasn't it? People don't play like that anymore.
No, they don't. Different styles have sort of been emulated. And, as groundbreaking pioneer playing as Coltrane was, he wasn't known for his beautiful sound. You know, when they asked Coltrane about, what do you think of Stan Getz's sound? He said, well, we'd all sound like that if we could.
but now nobody does.
No, nobody does. Yeah. and there were other, sounds that, came to be, huskiness or, clarity of sound or I've got one next week where we'll look at the sound that is sometimes indistinguishable from a car horn, the soprano sax. Usually there's some pretty ugly soprano sax sounds, but some guys can make it sound really beautiful. But that real airy kind of sax sound we don't hear. So that's why I've really enjoyed these albums, that there's some young guys who are saying, oh, we can do that old sound and make it cool.
Yeah, today. These Europeans are preserving America's past.
Well, I should say that Ben Webster lived in Denmark for a number of years. And I know that a lot of jazz musicians went to Scandinavia and also other parts of Europe, in Italy and France in the 50s and 60s, for various reasons, some to do with narcotics and other things. But not least of all was the appreciation for jazz music that they found there, more so than in America. So, the Danes and the other Scandinavian people have been listening to jazz for a long time, and there's several generations of great players there. And well, Snorri has got some nice compatriots here. He's got a few good videos on YouTube. Maybe I'll link the one in the studio recording I found with today's blog. And for me, it was a very happy discovery of something old but yet fresh again. So, I really strongly recommend this as feel-good album. Put this on, and you'll be in a good mood in no time.
It put the happy in my Easter.
Yes.
Okay.
All right, and we'll...
Fantastic. That was probably my album of the week, by the way, Snorri Kirk. I would recommend that, too.
You got to listen to Beat, then.
Okay, I will definitely do that.
Yeah, take out Beat. And we're going to go down to the boot of Italy.
Italy, and, my favorite country.
Help me with the pronunciation, Alger Darbugi.
My favorite non-United States country.
Yes. Did I pronounce that right?
Which one? The
title. How do we pronounce this?
Oh, hang on. I got to... Alger Darbugi.
Alger Darbugi, okay.
And this is the boogie means boogie woogie.
Yeah. And there's a story behind this title, which I'll just allude to a little bit. But this is on Parco della Musica Records. And the leader here is...
That should be the name of the album.
Yeah, Parco della Musica. But it's by one of the godfathers of Italian jazz, Dino Piana. And why I say that is, Italy has some great... jazz musicians and a great jazz culture, but in America, a lot of the names aren't so well known. I've tried to turn on a lot of my American friends to the current generation, Fabrizio Bosso, who I think is one of the greatest trumpet players in the world today, but he doesn't
get his Christmas album, actually. It's really great. Yeah.
He has amazing technique, great humor. He's on Blue Note, but, I think he's too good. And I think if he gets too well known in the States, a lot of American jazz trumpeters are going to have to hang up their horns, because this guy has got some scary chops and some fun ideas. But anyway, it goes back, the tradition of jazz in Italy goes back. And if we talk about modern jazz sort of, post-bop players, there's some really great other players. And one player who has quite a reputation in the West is Enrico Rava, because he was a sort of a fan of Chet Baker's music. And so he's made some recordings that were quite successful in the U.S., and he's got a good fan base around the world, I think. Now, this album was just released in March, but it was recorded in 2019, and Enrico Rava here, who is playing some fine trumpet, was 80 at the time, and sort of his mentor, who he speaks glowingly of in the information I can find about this album, is the valve trombonist Dino Piana, who was 89 at the time of this recording. Wow. And so Piana was one of the godfathers of this sort of modern style jazz in Italy, and inspired lots of other players, and is still sounding amazing at this age on valve trombone, which we don't hear hardly anyone play. When I think of valve trombone, I think of Bob Brookmeyer and Jerry Mulligan, back at that time. And so we've got this great album of a lot of pioneers of modern jazz in Italy in their extreme senior years and still having a great time and playing a whole album of jazz standards quite well right to this day. Also here we have Piana's son, Franco Piana, on flugelhorn, and Rava's playing flugelhorn too. Here we've got Julian Oliver Mazzariello on piano, Gabriel Evangelista on double bass, and Roberto Gatto on drums. Just a nice, enjoyable set of post-bop jazz standards. We've got, When Lights Are Low, a great tune, Bernie's tune, Polka Dots and Moonbeams, Rhythmening, I'll Close My Eyes. This is made famous by at least four trumpet players, by Blue Mitchell, on Blues Moods. This is one of the first jazz solos I learned by heart when I was transcribing off from records. When Will the Blues Leave, by Ornette Coleman. So we've got a little bit of, more progressive jazz. Everything Happens to Me, Dear Old Stockholm, and Line for Lion. So those two were sort of regular selections by Stan Getz and Chet Baker, who Rava has a big love for. So, standard jazz fare with these tunes, but lovingly played by these old masters. And so it's a very enjoyable recording and fun performance of these guys who have been playing together forever.
The key word for Italian jazz musicians is fun. And I got a real element of fun out of this, especially when they would play together. A lot of times there'd be these sort of runs while another player would hit these sort of, chords in the, at certain points of the run. It was really fantastic you kind of felt this whole joy of just locking in together. Italian musicians, with Italian music in general, it's virtuosic, it's fun. And those two things normally don't go together, but the Italians managed to combine those two. And also melodic. And Italians are really just great lovers of melody. You almost couldn't have there was an Italian avant-garde in the 20th century in classical music, but even so, they still came up with these appealing sounding lines, even in 12-tone music. I'm thinking of Luigi Nono and people like that. But what I was thinking of is that, the Ornette Coleman composition here, which is When Will the Blues Leave, right?
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. It still comes across as really so appealing, relaxed, and really fun. I know. Yeah. It's almost they can't make anything not fun. Italian jazz musicians, they really have this real... There's also kind of like a... Well, in classical music anyway, there's like a real spring to the rhythm. They kind of like make it more dancey than, like, for example, in Baroque music than it normally is. And in jazz, of course, which has like this kind of, you know, springy rhythm to begin with. Yeah, it's you know, it's just always there. I'm sure that it's that rhythm that drew Italian musicians to jazz in the first place. Right. Yeah, very playful album. It was really... there's a lot of joy. You can hear the musician's joy. You can get a sense of it from the playing. Keep an ear out for when these soloists are playing together, when there are two solos going on at the same time. Yeah, the way they just sort of lock in, they counterpoint each other, and they complement the harmony, like they fill in the harmony for something the other guy is playing. It's really amazing. This also put a big smile on my face, too. The Snorre Kirk had the swing thing going more here than this, but this within the playing, there's like just this wonderful playfulness to it. That's what really struck me about this record, and I will be adding it to my collection.
For just regular listeners who may not know with brass instruments too, brass instruments pose specific physical challenges with the body, in that the embouchure, so the lips and teeth are very delicate in, playing a brass instrument. And there are sort of ones where musicians can experience sort of shortened careers. You know, even in the 50s and 60s, a lot of brass players lose their chops or their teeth or a combination of both, and they can't play very well anymore.
Yeah, especially if they're taking narcotics. That's horrible.
But just in general, I mean, there are a lot of players who had brilliant chops in their 20s and 30s, but by their 40s, they were shot. And I won't name any names. But to be in your 80s...
It sort of happens to Denzel Washington's character in Mo Better Blues.
Yeah. So, it's happened to a lot of players. Yeah. But to be in your 80s or late 80s and still playing with pretty good chops and embouchure and sound is really quite amazing. There's not that many players who can do that. So for Italian jazz, there's lots of new generation players. And I imagine actually next week I've got one that is going to feature a present day new generation Italian player with some very interesting material, also Italian related. Teaser.
Don't tell him what it is. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. But I won't say it. You have to tune in next time. But
in the meantime, this is a fantastic record.
It's a great
Definitely
record.
Listen to it.
With
it's really
that
fun.
Sort of elder statesmen who are still showing they've got that mojo going, and really good times with Dino Piana. So check out this album. It'll put you in a good mood. It's got just that right atmosphere and relaxed Italian mood and good old tunes. Many of them you'll know if you're a jazz fan. And so those are the two sort of easily accessible swing and post-bop, but with jazz standards. And my last selection in the Italian jazz category, or rather European jazz category, is a stretch. And so to sort of introduce this one, what I'd like to say as part of adult music, in general, approaching music, people like familiarity. And so the average person who listens to music, say just pop music, I've read that it's probably about 92% familiarity ratio. In other words, when we listen to something in pop music on the radio or something, we're expecting almost all of what we hear to be something we've heard before in some sort of configuration. So that we're not too surprised. We need a little bit of novelty and something fresh to make this song more interesting, but not too much so that we are uncomfortable with what we hear, or we're too surprised, or it requires too much concentration or effort. In other words, then it will be almost like work, and the average person will be turned away. Now, more aficionados of any music style will be expecting more of a challenge. Now, in classical music, that could be something in serialism. You know,
that's a real challenge.
Yeah, 12-tone things. Or a new style, jumping eras where there's different conventions of compositional style that we're going to have to adjust to hear something we haven't heard before.
Yeah, but even a Wagner opera would be like a real challenge. You know,
it's a challenge.
Not hearing that's a right. cadence through like an entire work, basically. You know, it's
in classical music also, we're looking at something that requires a commitment of attention over a longer time period than the person who only listens to, say, pop music is.
Music like that is the broccoli of music.
Broccoli of music. The Brussels sprouts.
It's good for you.
Yes.
It's good for you.
So instead of a 3 to 4 minute song, you know, we're going to take a minimum of 30 minutes for a work, or even longer if we're listening to Mahler or Wagner. You know, it could be an extended length of time. Right. We're going to have to follow, remember themes that will come back in various permutations. And
sometimes an hour later.
An hour later. So we're requiring, memory and things like that. Now, in terms of jazz, jazz was once the popular music of America and Europe in the great roaring 20s and into the swing era, when it was largely entertainment and jazz music. Of course, bebop turned that all on its head and made sort of music for the musicians. In retrospect, it's very approachable now because they were still largely working with standard tunes. And although they became very inventive harmonically and improvised melodies on that, the structure was still very sort of identifiable, the song forms. After that, we had modal jazz in the 1960s and cool jazz, which is still very relatable. But then we get into sort of free jazz in the 60s, abandoning sort of conventions of song forms and harmony. That sort of gets kind of out there. And so you get less and less of identifiable things to listen to in all the categories of sort of compositional style, harmonic structure, and also melodies. And, these days there's still an avant-garde and more free aspect to jazz. And this last album is a bit free and progressive in that sense. It's always good to challenge ourselves wherever we are to listen to something new. And so that's what I did with this one, because I was intrigued by the concept. So the final selection for this week is a recording called String Dancers. And this is a guitar duo, which was also intriguing to me because I also play guitar.
Hence the title String Dancers, so String Dancing Dancers. On the Strings of the Guitar.
That's right. And by Slovenian guitarist Samo Salomon.
Yeah.
And who's caught some attention. I believe he was featured in Guitar Player magazine. And he's been, until now, mainly known as an electric guitarist. But this album is all 6 and 12 string acoustic guitar, which I thought is kind of, and it was something different for him. And the other guitarist is Hasse Poulsen, a Danish guitarist. And this is sort of a product of the coronavirus situation, as I read from this album when I saw it. And I was intrigued because there have been a number of historic sort of guitar duets, so to speak, going back, duo and trio recordings mixed together. Of course, the famous recordings by Aldi Meola, John McLaughlin and Paco de Lucia, going back to the 80s or so, when they recorded in duos and trios together. There's the great European French guitarist Sylvain Luc and Borelli Legrain have recorded a number of duet albums together. And just recently, who has passed away, the great American guitarist Tony Rice recorded a very forward sort of album with jazz guitarist John Carlini that featured sort of a mixture of country roots music and jazz. So guitar duo is kind of an interesting sort of format to have in music. And I thought I would check this one out because Solomon usually plays electric guitar, and his major influence, I believe, is John Scofield. But here he's gone to an acoustic format. And from what I could read about the inspiration for this, as many musicians around the world were frustrated in the coronavirus situation of not having an opportunity to make live performances, he wanted to keep his creative sort of juices flowing. And he had listened to some recordings of Poulsen, the Danish guitarist, and sort of reached out to him over the internet saying, you know, he was interested in his work, and I've got these compositions, and let's do some free improvisation together. And Poulsen replied to him and said, that sounds good, let's focus on compositions too and see what we can do together. And unfortunately, the technical details of how they did this are left out. I'm wondering if they used something like Zoom with its sort of high-resolution music feature, which was used for other music performances. They must have collaborated and recorded these over the internet in using some technology, because from what I read, once their emails exchange or whatever had happened, they actually started recording these things right away. So they didn't waste any time after sharing these compositions, and they got right into it, which is kind of interesting. And this release is actually not on any music label. It's self-released by Solomon himself. So he sort of took over the production roles. And it actually, the sound quality is quite impressive. You wouldn't know that this wasn't recorded in a studio or a room together. But what you've got here is some rather very complex modern compositions of music that doesn't follow, sort of a traditional jazz sort of
Yeah, it's not sequences. Traditional.
No, but there are some very classical-like compositions with very interesting rhythms and lots of free improvisation. And so what you'll notice with this is a challenging listen. You're not going to put this on for background music when you're doing the household chores. But there is a lot of interesting interplay and communication between the musicians, even more so if they were doing this over the internet, which is assumed by the information and the conditions we're under now with the coronavirus. So there's a lot of, it's not a traditional sort of jazz style of playing. It's not swing or in bebop or post-bop. It's a very modern with lots of interesting rhythmic variations, free improvisation, borrowing from a lot of styles, almost some like flamenco-like type of playing sometimes, some very modern jazz style playing with other sort of just sound improvisations. And really pushing the limits of compositional structure, and then being really out there with not being locked into any sort of key or scale structure. The title track for this one, The String Dancers, I thought was maybe one of the more accessible ones, with these long building lines of melodies. There is structure in here if you devote the attention to listen to it. But it's buried in lots of freedom in here. So this is kind of a difficult listen, but it may be rewarding to people who want some sort of challenge of the limits of free expression, and also anyone who may be a guitarist or guitar heads, because these guys obviously have a lot of technical skill on their instruments. And that's kind of interesting to explore here too. And I think it may be a little bit outside of the box from what they usually do, and maybe inspired by the current situation that we're at. So this is sort of out on a limb on the extremes of modern jazz, but still somewhat accessible. It's not completely free jazz. It's tied to composition, but has lots of open space for exploration.
Yeah, I just want to... I think you're saying that it's difficult, but it's not difficult like, say, like Ornette Coleman or Cecil Taylor are difficult. You know, it's sort of, it's listenable. It's certainly listenable.
Oh, no.
It's complex.
It's complex, yeah. It's not free jazz. In other words, they didn't start out with a complete, like, let's start playing and see what happens. They had very well-defined compositions to work from. There are two tracks here that are labeled as like Improvisation 1 and Improvisation 2, which seem to be maybe completely
improvised,
well, unprepared sort of things. But the rest, there are some very complex structures with lines and meters here that aren't easy to identify. Once you start listening to me, you realize there's some sort of sequence going on in the intervals and the rhythms that they're playing. So it's not that far out there. Certainly, if you've listened to free jazz, not compared to that, no.
Yeah, listening to it, it seems that the two guitars are playing against each other for a lot of the time. They're not really trying to like make a harmony like on the Italian record that we just heard, the Dino Piani one. I wonder how much of this material was what they call in classical music aleatoric, which means that there's like a set thing that you play, but when you play it is really up to you. You know, it kind of seemed like certain things came in at really odd times. This music was kind of intellectual, and I didn't have any problem with it, actually. I didn't think it was really that difficult. But if you listen to one like work, say in the headphones, you can hear all the interaction. And it's fairly satisfying. You did a little intellectual exercise, and then you hear the next one, and then you hear the next one, and then you hear the next one, and it's just kind of wearing. I think that my issue with this album was as a program, it got to be too much. I think as individual tracks, it's much more listenable. If you listen to like one track one day, and then maybe the next track the next day, something like that, you can really get the most out of it. It's two acoustic guitars. They kind of, you know, they sound like guitars. The timbre doesn't change. Like for example, on the Piazzolla albums that we talked about before, the sound of the solo instrument is kind of set off by the differing orchestration. First, you have an orchestra. Then there's a solo guitar accompanying the accordion or the trumpet, and then there's maybe a string quartet and things like that. So the ear is always engaged. Here it sort of becomes like a, you know, how long is this going to go on for sort of thing. But the compositions themselves are interesting enough, and I don't think they're a bit of a challenge, but they're not difficult. I think just as a program, it was just kind of hard to get through. I probably should have listened to it on different days and not just tried to hear the whole thing at once.
Yeah,
that's all I would say about it.
Myself not being a big fan of like free jazz, so to speak, the way that it's been sort of incorporated into the mainstream, rather than listening to a whole free jazz album, which can be quite wearing, like the way you'll often hear it is that, you know, in a given jazz ensemble's repertoire, there'll be certain songs that will have a free section in it that's sort of sandwiched by a tune that has a regular head and chorus and things. And then the free section will be some extended, soloing or band solo section that abandons the structure for a time for sort of unlimited creativity, and then resolves into that, you know, riff or thing that came at the beginning. Or you may hear a song that's sort of, you know, more free in one song in a program. But then when you have a whole program of that type of thing, you're saying, it's a bit much altogether. Yeah,
it's kind of like hearing like an entire semester's worth of college lectures in an 8-hour period. hearing them all back to back, you know.
Yeah.
Like, those great courses, like online kind of you know, lecture series, you know, of 24 lectures. It's like trying to listen to all of those in one day.
Yeah.
It's
kind of, there's a lot there.
It's too much.
And like I say, I think it's that mix of familiarity and novelty. Yeah. And then
there's not enough timbral variety to kind of keep in it either. Yeah, that's part of the problem.
Just the two guitars. So, I mean, it was interesting, and I thought it was the reason I picked up on it too was just sort of it was a product of our current times, and as that and a player that I had seen Solomon's name mentioned before, but I hadn't listened to him, so I thought, oh, this is interesting. And since it was self-released, I thought it would be worth investigating. And I'm glad I did. And I think, you know, that's part of the adult music mind frame is that we're willing to expand and check out new frontiers from time to time. So I like to encourage myself to do that and encourage our listeners to broaden their horizons and take a chance on some new different things sometimes.
Yeah, speaking of broadening your horizons, I'm reminded of something that the British music teacher and I guess musicologist Otto Károlyi said, or he wrote in a book that I read that made a big, profound effect on me. And he said, you shouldn't say, I know what I like when you're talking about music. Instead, you should say, I don't know what I could like. All right? So if you don't know what you could like, that means you're going to listen to something that's really unfamiliar, and you're going to be wondering to yourself, do I like this? And that's really the way I approach music ever since I read that. And it's really opened up a whole lot of new horizons for me. Now, some of the things I heard, I couldn't like. But there was a lot of other stuff that kind of got in there after a while. One of them was, I'll give you an example of the music of Olivier Messiaen, okay, which is really hard to hear because he's got this really unique sound world. And it took me a long time to like his music. I didn't like it right away, but I didn't dismiss it. There was something in it that kind of appealed to me. And it took, like, I remember just years, but I didn't, it wasn't like I kept trying either. The music was just always being performed. The new recordings came out, and I just kind of listened to them every once in a while. And then one day I just got it. I kind of knew, you know, I kind of figured out at least my version of what he was after. And right. I was able to latch on to some of his ideas, even his non-musical ideas to help me get into the music.
Okay, that's so a good philosophy.
Know
what
I could like, it was a really good thing. One thing I once read an article that said that once you reach around the age of 30, your musical tastes are set. You know, you're not really going to be exploring all that much. But they're not really set. It's not, but it depends on you. I think, like for me, I'm always going to like one of my favorite sounds in all of music is just the jangly guitar of like say the Birds or you know that sort of that Rickenbacker sound. Right. And every time I hear it, I just love you know hearing it. So that's something that's just kind of set in my mind. But it doesn't mean that that's what I'm going to listen to for the rest of my life. I mean, I don't certainly want to hear that. I want to keep kind of you know going out and just kind of finding new things and seeing if I can find a way to like this music that I. I'm not really grabbing on to. This is a good podcast for me to be on because Russ is hitting me with a lot of new stuff, which I'm really enjoying.
Well, and likewise. I think that's the one thing, too. I mean, traditionally, until this point, in the world we grew up in the 20th century, that, you know, you would not necessarily be exposed to new music by just turning on the radio in the car.
Right.
And when you have the classic rock station and the country station and the classical station, you know, you could get quite comfortable and never be exposed to something new. And certainly that's the same possibility exists in our modern sort of streaming. A lot of the articles I've read about the effect is that it's even more reinforced that people end up listening to even more of what everyone else is listening to because it's just, you know, just as easy to do. You would think there would be more freedom. There actually is more freedom, but you have to be open to that. And yeah, there's a whole world out there to explore. And, you know, that's part of what we think of as the adult music. I want to push my borders. And also I find not only listening to new things, but sort of changing the concepts I had. Well, one thing related to today's program is, say, tango. You know, I thought of when I was young, tango was sort of, you know, this sort of music that was just for dancing with some right. interesting costumes. And then I heard a guitarist, Juanjo Dominguez, who you know, plays sort of all of these great tango music on guitar and in guitar trios. And when I heard that, I thought, wow, this is more depth to this music than I thought was there at the beginning. And it really opened my mind to this, you know, genre of music that was there. And so I think you can find new things. You can also sort of explode sort of stereotypes or limits you had on other types of music. Another area for me that I'm doing that is like with country music, which was sort of, you know, country music was sort of something I wasn't interested in. But now that sort of stigma has been opened with like roots music and Americana. And there's a lot of great artists who are finding authenticity and weeding out sort of the pop sentimentalities that have sort of found their way into that music. And so we've got, you know, some people that we like together, Jason Isbell and who's our other guy? We
some popular music for adults, let's say.
Yeah, yeah. So there's good pop music, and there's also something inventive and lots of other other styles of music that can emerge even when your concept is sort of solidified on those kind of things. So
yeah, Jason Isbell, it's funny you should mention him, because he has an interesting way of thinking. Like, his songwriting is really unique. I think of this one song he has called If We Were Vampires.
Oh, that's a great song. Yeah,
it's a great lyric. Basically, the song is, you know, correct me, I haven't heard this in a while. Correct me if I don't have this right, but he's singing to his girlfriend, his lover.
Right.
You know, if we were vampires, we would be able to live forever, but we probably, you know, we wouldn't, you know, we could be together forever, but we probably wouldn't love each other, because it's probably the fact that we're going to die one day.
Yeah, one of us would have to spend some time alone.
Yeah, one of us would have to spend some time. It's really a beautiful song.
One day I'd be gone, or one day you'd be gone, yeah.
Yeah.
So his songs have that you know, really interesting lyrical quality. And who's the other one I'm thinking? Sturgill Simpson.
Oh, he's good too. Yeah, yeah, I like him. He's just put out a bunch of
bluegrass versions of his old songs.
Of his own songs, yeah.
Yeah, so really guys like that have sort of, you know, changed my image of what the limits of country music were, sort of bringing this sort of honesty and great lyrical and musical quality into country music, which to me had just sort of become too much like pop and rock to be, you know, that well noticed. So I think, yeah,
country music, you know, the image we have, there's an old joke about country music. What happens if you play a country song backwards?
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. What is it? Your wife comes back,
and your car comes back. Yeah, your truck comes back,
and your dog is alive again.
Yeah, your dog's alive. Yeah. But so
I think that cliche is already gone, I think, you know.
Yeah, so I mean, there's so many avenues to explore with re-exploring concepts that you had, and also then listening to music that you've never listened to before. So I want to be open to, you know, all of those kind of things, and hopefully our audience is too.
Yeah. Keep
those ears wide open. If you've made it this far on episode 8 of Adult Music, the podcast with music for the mature mind, we thank you for listening. And again, we invite you to, when whatever service or format you're listening to, please give us a rating or ranking in whatever format is available. And also leave a comment. We're most interested to hear from you. And we also, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, have our own podcast email, which is one word, adultmusicpodcast@gmail.com. Drop us a line. Send us a message. Where are you? What are you listening to? What do you think?
Podcast singular with no S at the end. It's
no
a T.
S at the end.
Podcast.
That's right.
With a and, T at the end.
Let us know where you are and what you're listening to, and we'd be happy to learn more about our audience and hear who you are and what you're listening to and where you are. and we want to grow our audience. So any feedback you give us will help us to expand at this point.
Yeah, if you have any questions about music or about us, you can ask. We'd be glad to talk about that. And if you want us to talk about a certain album, let us know. We'll certainly think about it.
We'll probably do it, actually.
But we have a ton of stuff we want to talk about now anyway.
That's right. I think we've got picks set for the next couple of weeks, pretty much.
I've got 2 weeks worth of picks right now.
I've got some good jazz for next week. And it's going to be a very profitable spring for music. It looks like there's lots of stuff coming out, and there's a few things that I'm just waiting that aren't out yet, but I know that are coming out. So
it's so exciting. Good. I'm happy. Russ, are you happy?
I'm very happy. That's what spring is about, right?
And that's all what about music is about too,
the budding and birthing of something new. So
music, if you're feeling down, music can change your mood like that. Just put on your favorite song, it'll change everything, at least for that moment.
That's right.
All right.
Lots to look forward to. Mm. So, thank you for listening, and we will see you again in episode 9 next week. So, stay tuned and keep listening.
Bye.